42 for the high. Sunday, 43. This morning, wind is from the southwest at 9. Now 25 degrees, both Kenosha and Racine. 22 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill is 15. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. I'm excited about the next few minutes because this is a topic that speaks very directly to me, and I'm sure to many of you. As someone who just celebrated his 50th birthday not long ago, I am very intrigued with a book called The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. In this intriguing book, Barbara Strauch, a deputy science editor at the New York Times, discusses some of the ways in which the brain of the typical middle-aged person is actually a wondrous thing, despite the fact that when we get to this point in our lives, we tend to be forgetful about at least certain things in ways that we never were before, and probably in other ways feel like our brains do not operate as efficiently as they once did. But Barbara Strauch's contention is that this is really a fairly significant misunderstanding and underappreciation for the brain in middle age, and that in fact at this point in our lives we are better equipped than ever to do many things, and that many of our cognitive functions are, if anything, better than when we were younger. And her book helps us understand better how the brain works, memory in particular, and some of the means by which we might keep our cognitive processes as sharp and clear and well-running as possible. The book, again, is called The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, and you may know Barbara Strauch's name from previous books such as The Primal Teen, What the New Discoveries About the Teenage Brain Tell Us About Our Kids, and some of her other writing as well. Barbara Strauch, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Look forward to this very much. Your biography mentions the fact that you've been at the New York Times for quite some time, and you've been sort of around the block there at the Times in terms of different things that you have done, including being a media editor, working at the national desk, and so on, eventually migrating over to the science beat and the health and medical beat. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, it's certainly not unprecedented for someone in your line of work to kind of bounce around different beats. That's one of the things that makes it such stimulating work. But did anything in particular draw you over to the science desk?
Well, I have done many, many things. I've been in the newspaper business for too long to mention. But I have, at a certain point, I did cover science and health in Boston and Houston at newspapers when I was there, and I've just always been fascinated by it. I had a mother, an English major, and a father who was actually a space scientist. So I grew up with science all around me and English on the other side. So I've always had kind of these two parts to me. So I think I've always been drawn to it. And, as you know, in the news business, at a certain point, we like to keep learning stuff. And I think the science department of the New York Times is increasingly unique, unfortunately, in that we really do I look into things with rigor. We keep up with the latest science, and there's many debates within the department itself as to what a finding might mean. So it's a very stimulating environment and a place where you can really see the new stuff coming down the pike, and I find that fascinating. So that has certainly spurred me to write both of these books, because I'm lucky enough to be in a seat where I can see the edge of the field and see what's new and what the best scientists are thinking about. And for me, it's just really, really fun.
I can't let this opportunity go by without just asking you one quick follow-up to that. I think one of the things that is very intriguing about your work is the fact that, particularly when it comes to certain questions, certain issues, certain challenges, there sometimes can be a great deal of diversity of opinion, or you might have most of the scientific community feeling a particular way, holding a certain position, and then certain scientists, maybe many fewer, but holding kind of a contrary view. And sometimes we also are dealing with the reality of studies, so-called studies about a certain something that aren't really rigorous studies at all. I wonder if you could just say a word about how you and your colleagues sort of make sense of all of this. I mean, that, for instance, you know, what is the difference between good science and so-so science, and good scientists and not so good scientists, and you as yourself not being a scientist per se, how do you navigate what can really be a complicated landscape?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think this, in particular, medical science area that I'm now am in charge of at the New York Times, really was one of the toughest that I've confronted, and part of that has to do with what you mentioned, and that there's a great deal of hype out there. There's a lot of studies that, you know, we see it pop up on the morning news or whatever, and you know, do this, do that, take this, drink that, you know, and what is real and what really works. And the other issue is that over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of money that is poured into this field. And so the scientists themselves can sometimes be motivated by the wrong thing. There's a lot of conflict of interest out there. So we, I think, try very hard to sort through all that. And the only way you can really do that is to actually look at the studies themselves, see what kind of controls they had, see how the study was set up, see if it's significantly powerful, and also talk to enough people. And, you know, we're lucky enough at the New York Times to have fabulous reporters who have really been doing this for decades, and they know who will be honest and who won't, and who's basically getting money from the big pharmacology companies and who isn't, and who really will tell you the straight story. And then they are also quite good at, you know, you get pretty good at looking at the studies themselves and understanding which ones can be trusted and which ones can't. But it's hard work, I must say.
I should think it's also hard work to take what are probably sometimes very complicated things and conveying them to your readers in a fashion that is going to make sense without sort of boiling it down to pablum. Is that as hard as I imagine it is?
Well, it is, and that's a fine line that we try not to talk down to our readers, but we want people to understand and follow along what the thinking is, even of the scientists. You know, we try to take you in there and say, well, this is what the thinking is, and we might as well tell you what we know. We really very much believe in telling you what we know and making it as clear as possible, and that's where, you know, my English background maybe helps. It's my job to basically not be a scientist at some times and make sure that, you know, that the stuff we write can be understandable to somebody who is just, you know, the very interested reader.
We're speaking with Barbara Strauch, and the task at hand is to speak about her new book called The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. Just ahead of that, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't talk at least a moment or two about your previous book, which was really focused on the teenage mind. Tell us what prompted you to write your book called The Primal Teen.
Well, at that point, I had a couple of teenagers living with me. They're now back, actually, but they seem to be in their 20s, so they're on their own. But, yeah, at that point, I had some teenagers living with me, and One, it had actually some difficulties with learning disabilities, and I watched the different patterns of their growth and a different way their brains were operating, and I became kind of fascinated by it. You know, we spend so much time as parents sort of focusing on every little moment of toddlerhood, and I think we kind of miss out on what is an even more fabulous and wondrous thing in front of us happening when they're adolescents. You know, we're so angry at them sometimes, you know, and they make us crazy. So it's easy to miss what's actually happening in their brains in terms of development. And, you know, again, in my seat at the New York Times, I'm lucky enough to see the new science, and I began to see some really, really good studies coming out that had followed with brain scanners the same teenagers as their brains grew. And this was the very first time they did it at the National Institutes of Health and our tax dollars at work, and they did a very, very good job, and they were completely surprised by what they found.
And what they found helps us understand what makes teenagers tick, evidently.
Well, right. So they found in particular that their brains are, you know, they thought they were over at puberty. They found that actually there's a huge growth spurt of brain branches at puberty, and then the brain does kind of an about face in mid-adolescence and starts pruning back, carving away brain branches and losing as much as 50% in some areas until, and that whole renovation project, that whole remodeling is not over until the kids are 25. And I think that's about 10 years, if not more, longer than people thought in the past. They thought it was really a done deal much earlier. And, of course, that really creates a great deal of hope for parents. That means that, you know, this blob that's sitting in front of you is not finished. But it also is more worrisome because it means that it's a developmental stage where the brain is much more vulnerable. So it's kind of a mixed message, but fascinating.
Hmm. One of the things you mentioned in your introduction is that after that book about the teenage brain was published, you did, of course, a lot of book tours and speaking to various groups on the topic, and often you'd be driven back to the airport by someone who was fairly close in age to you, you know, probably more or less middle-aged, and you suggest that at least more than once someone has said, when are you going to write a book about our brains, that meaning the middle-aged brain? Does that question really pose to you from time to time?
Yes, right. They'd say, oh, my goodness, you know, that's nice about the teenage brain and really interesting, but, you know, my brain is suddenly, they were worried, you know. They'd say, my brain is suddenly awful. I can't remember anything, and I'm looking around for my glasses, and they're up on top of my head, and, you know, what was that movie I saw, and who is that person in the elevator? And, you know, I think, and that made me think about my own issues with, you know, brains, my middle-aged brain, and clearly, you know, the cliche is senior moments or whatever, but we aren't that senior, and they are happening, and what's going on? I mean, where do those names go? Are they up in the clouds laughing at us? And so I began to think, well, what's going on in middle age? What is going on?
I thought it was interesting that you actually begin your introduction by, even ahead of talking specifically about brain function in the middle-aged person, to just kind of talk about how for a long, long time, the whole notion of middle-aged, first of all, was rather neglected in terms of being
right,
written about and talked about, and that also that even the notion of what middle-aged is quite different now compared to what it once was because of this matter of increased lifespan. Just sketch for us kind of that change in perspective about this whole thing which we call middle-aged.
Well, that was one of the most surprising things to me. You know, as I was writing the book, I kept saying, you know, to other people, I kept saying, you know, it never really even occurred to me that, you know, this is the very first time on the planet as a human species that we've had this long stretch in the middle. You know, lifespans, as you say, have increased. At the turn of the century, there was average 48. Now it's average 80 and 80 years, and those are averages. So we never really had much time for the middle, and now we have this long stretch. The modern middle age is considered, I mean, this is a time when you're no longer young and not yet old, and there, you know, the modern middle age can go from 40 to 65, if not beyond, and so now we have this period of time, and again, we've never had it before, and many of us because of in the developed world, in any case, because of childhood vaccines and healthier childhoods, we are entering this period in much better shape. So not only is it new for us, but we have a different kind of brain going into it. And what we have now also, for the very first time, is there are some very astute people who began studying this in the 50s and said, well, gee, we seem to have a little bit more time in the middle here. Let's start looking at it. And they now, those people, have 40 years of data that they've looked at the same people, longitudinal studies where they study the same people, thousands of people. And the results are now coming out, and they're telling us that this new modern age is completely different from what we ever thought about a middle age before. And I think that's, you know, one scientist said it was like studying, you know, nuclear physics or something, because it is so new, everything we find out about it is brand new.
And in particular, what we find out about the middle-aged brain.
Right. Well, that was completely neglected. As they started looking at us, our bodies and our lives, and, you know, a lot of myths came up with the midlife crisis and empty nest syndromes that were, you know, came at the beginning of this new modern middle age when we first started having it, and everyone gave it this kind of sour note. I'm not quite sure why. But now, on top of the talking about our lives in our bodies, they're now looking with these new sophisticated tools we have, and also these long-term studies, they're trying to figure out what is going on with our brains, and it is completely, completely surprising.
Ahead of us talking about some of these findings and some of the specific information which we now know about the brain, and now specifically for our conversation today, the middle-aged brain, could you help us understand how such a thing gets studied? I mean, for instance, some of these really fascinating longitudinal studies. Tell us more about, I mean, this harkens back to my question, I guess, earlier in the conversation about what's good science versus not so good science. And clearly you find this to be very compelling, very good science. I think it would be helpful if we heard just a little bit more about how some of these studies have been conducted. I mean, how does one study the human brain, and particularly the middle-aged human brain?
Well, for the when you talk about the longitudinal studies, for instance, let's just start with those. And you are right to say that longitudinal means that you're studying the same people, not random people. You're studying the same people as they age through their lives. And there's a number of these longitudinal studies that were launched in the 50s, and these are people who agreed to be studied throughout their lives, all occupations, you know, genders, all ethnic and all economic levels. And so they study them from the beginning. They give them cognitive tests, for instance, as they're younger. And then every 5 years or 6 years or something, those same people come back in, and they are studied and given the same kinds of tests again. And later on, as these tools develop, they added things like brain scanners. This is new. They're trying to find out what's actually going on inside their brains as they are aging, the same people. And this kind of study is considered, you know, this is the gold standard for studies in terms of populations of people, because you want to see there's great variation in brains, great variations in people. So you really want to study the same people if you can, and thousands of them. If you can. And that's what these studies have done, and they really are pretty solid. And they come up with surprisingly similar results, too. And then, of course, what they also have now are these brain scanners, and they can go in and actually watch what's happening with the brain in middle age, and they can watch it, for instance, they can watch it get distracted more often than a younger brain, and they can watch it, other parts of it, they can watch it actually react to the world in a calmer way than when younger. So those kinds of studies are really brand new. And again, you have to make sure that you're talking to the scientists that have done a lot of this stuff and have a track record and know how to not overinterpret their data, but actually, you know, are cautious about what they're finding.
Can I get some clarification on the second thing you were talking about? And I know you're talking about kind of a breakthrough in technology, which in your words allows us to see the brain as it is in these various states of activity. What exactly are we seeing, or what exactly is a scientist looking at in the brain?
Well, they'd be looking at it in a most fundamental way. They'd be looking at, there's a lot of studies of exercise, for instance, is one of the better things they thought that you can do for your brain. And they've now studied that over and over again, and it really does seem to be the superstar in terms of the aging brain. They can watch people who, you know, who do some particularly walking vigorously, and then they put them in a brain scanner, and they find out that, you know, their brain, compared to the people who didn't do that, their brains have a larger brain volume. And then they give them cognitive tests, and they do better on the cognitive tests. And they even have found, most recently, that with animals and humans, that exercise can help you produce baby brain cells in the hippocampus, in the part of our brain that forms memories. So that is completely new. So we are really out on the edge in terms of finding out, looking inside our brain to see what is going on. And they can watch, there's all sorts of things they're watching now. They're watching the brain kind of reorganize itself in middle age and use even more of itself to get jobs done. And that's also fascinating. So, you know, people who need to do a task, for instance, you know, they'll use two sides of their brains instead of one, and they find out that those are the people who are the most cognitively astute. These are the people whose brains are the best, are actually using more of their brains to solve problems than they did when they were younger. And, you know, at first it's kind of a thought that would make you say, uh-oh, that means their brains are declining. And but what it really means is that if the brain finds a deficit or something in some part, if it's a healthy brain, it can go over and use other parts of itself. And just as we might use, you know, another hand if one was, you know, damaged or something. And that means you can get the job done. And it's the people who, again, who are the smartest who do this.
I think what's a little bewildering to, well, me for one, but I think probably for a lot of people is, I mean, if it were possible for us to open up someone's skull and just look at a brain,
right,
with our eyes, we wouldn't see anything.
No.
But obviously technology is allowing us to see things that,
right,
the human eye doesn't otherwise see at all. I mean, is there really visual information that is clear? Or, I mean, what
yeah,
exactly do these brain scans reveal? I mean, what kind of information or data does a brain scan give a scientist?
Well, they can, on one level, measure brain volume. You know, they can put you in an MRI and see actual the physical structures of your brain and measure brain volume in certain parts of your brain. And they've now mapped, you know, the brain well enough to know pretty much what part is where. So now they can go in and watch what changes in those parts. So on a very fundamental level, although none of this is easy, of course, they can measure brain volume by measuring you before you have exercise and after you have exercise or before you do something. And the other thing they can do is when our brains are working, they are activated, and they can set the machines to detect that kind of activation. It's kind of a magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs, which we're all pretty familiar with. We know they can see inside our brains, and they see the structure in our brains, and they can also see when the brain is actually active in a certain area, and they can watch it, you know, light up in the frontal cortex when it's trying to solve a problem, or it can light up on one side of itself or another side of itself. And those machines are set up so that they can see that activity and see how it changes with age or with different tasks. And I think when these first came out, you know, there were all sorts of studies that said, you know, different parts of your brain, if you name fruit or something, this part lights up and that part lights up. And it was pretty rudimentary, and we had a lot of kind of silly studies in a way. But now they're very sophisticated, and they're getting pretty good baselines for how normal brains look. You know, they're even trying to get into Alzheimer's now and try to figure out, can they detect it earlier? And because they get have a better sense of what a normal brain looks like, and that's really what was missing, was a sense of what does a normal brain look like. They were always looking for pathology and illness, and now over the last 10 years they have a pretty good baseline as to what a normal hippocampus looks like, for instance. And if they can scan you and find out that there's a lot of hippocampus missing, they would certainly think that you have some sort of illness. So really it's become much more sophisticated, I would say, over the last 10 years.
Hmm. We're speaking with Barbara Strauch about her book, The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. You point out a couple of misassumptions that lots of us tend to make. One of them is this. You say, over the years, we've been trained to think that the body and the brain age in tandem. Certain bodily changes are undeniable. We know all about that. And as we watch our hair on our head turn gray or disappear altogether, we assume that there's equivalent decay inside our heads. It's not hard to imagine our neurons turning their own shades of brownish gray, drying up or disappearing altogether. You tell us that, in fact, science should disavow us of this notion.
Right. I think, you know, there's no question that, you know, the brain ages just like everything else, obviously. So, but what we're looking at with our bodies is sometimes the effects of sun or oxidation or, you know, things that, you know, we can actually see the color leave our hair or whatever. And I think we tend to think that, you know, the effects of that kind of physical aging on our that we can see on our bodies is necessarily happening to our organs inside, and in particular the brain. The brain is set up to repair itself and to regenerate itself. We're born with the brain cells. They don't divide like skin cells, and so they stay with us most of our lives. They used to think that we lost 30% of our brain cells as we aged, for instance, and that was done by some spotty studies of autopsies and things. And again, now that they can get in there with brain scanners and with more sophisticated tools, they find that this is not the case, that we keep most of our brain cells. There's some shrinkage of brain branches and some decreases in neurotransmitters, and they do think that the brain shrinks on average maybe 2% a decade, but it's nowhere near what people thought was happening in our brains. In fact, our brains stay intact, and they reorganize, and they can rejuvenate, and they can, they're set up really to kind of, you know, step up to the plate and do what they need to do. And,
the term you use at one point is adapt. Our brains adapt in middle age.
They do, and because they need to, in part, you know, and because this is the organ that is set up to adapt to different environments and things, it's what its job is. So there's no question that it also adapts to aging.
You tell us that one of the things that is that makes this a complicated, fascinating picture is that there are certain ways in which our middle-aged brains are better, stronger, more efficient than our younger brain, and then there are other ways in which the brain, in your words, is no longer pristine. I think you used that word at some point.
Right.
So we should kind of talk about this mixed picture, which I think is so interesting. Tell us, for instance, something which you regard as one of the most important discoveries about the middle-aged brain. You talk about a sort of new brain state. You call it a default mode, a kind of daydreaming state, which we don't see very much in the younger brain, evidently. And we see it often, maybe too often sometimes, in the middle-aged brain. What is this exactly that we're talking about?
Well, it is new, and a new brain state. They call it the default mode, but it really is kind of that inner monologue that I think we're all familiar with, a kind of daydreaming state. And obviously, it happens at any age, but what they find at middle age and beyond is that the brain can flip into that state more quickly, more often, and I would say maybe at times that are inappropriate, you know, when you're driving down the road and you suddenly look up and think, oh, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, what I was going to wear to work and I haven't been watching the road. So it's kind of scary. And what they think is that our prefrontal cortex, again, this part of the brain that is the most sophisticated and develops the latest in adolescence, the part right behind our forehead that sees, solutions and consequences. And that part is a very adaptable part of our brain and develops latest, and it may start to get a little dicier first as well. And that's the part of our brain that sort of keeps out this irrelevant material. And it can get a little bit less efficient at that, so that we can lose focus and get a little more distracted as we age. You know, you're boiling water, potatoes, and somebody comes to the door, and you go and answer the door, and you forget all about the potatoes. So, you know, that kind of thing happens, and it's scary, but it's not a big deal, and it has to do in part with this increased distractibility or even flipping into this daydreaming mode that the scientists have just discovered. And again, that's probably the role of prefrontal cortex, and you need to, the best advice, I think, is that, you know, you have to force yourself to focus, particularly at the beginning of tasks when you're, as you age, so that you can keep out that distracting material that is irrelevant.
Another interesting distinction which you make in your book is how often with the middle-aged brain we will recognize a face or we'll recognize a name, but we might not necessarily put it together as easily as we once did who exactly this person is, or
right.
Why do I know them, or why does that name seem familiar? I'm trying to find that moment in the book where you talk about that. Mm-hmm. I think you say that this kind of memory retrieval is something like maybe sequential memory or something like
episodic
that.
Memory,
episodic,
right,
that's it.
Is one term for, that's the term for, you know, you're trying to remember an event in context or how you know someone. Like you might see somebody on the street and you say, oh, I know that guy, but, you know, from where? From church? From, you know, the softball field or from work? Or, you know, where do I know that guy from? And so this sense of familiarity does not go away, and that what they're finding now is that the memory, of course, is not one thing, that it is many different kinds of things. And, you know, there's autobiographical memory. You know, I have a brother in Phoenix. I don't forget that. You know, there's, you know, we remember how to wash our hands and throw a ball, also different kinds of memory. So what they find is that there's a little bit of certainly some declines in what we think of as short-term memory in particular, and that would be, you know, what was the movie I saw last weekend, and, you know, have I read this book? You know, stuff like that seems to kind of vanish sometimes or a little bit more often as we age, and particularly names, I think, drive us crazy and are scary. And there's a woman out at Pomona College who studied this, what she calls tip of the tongue, tots, she calls them, and I think we all know what those feel like. You know, you know the name, but it's on the tip of your tongue, and you can't quite bring it to mind. And she does find, of course, this happens at any age, but it happens more often as we enter a middle age and further on. And what she finds is that there's actually a single connection between the sound of a word and the information about a name in our brains, and that through disuse, if you haven't seen somebody in a while, or through aging, can get a little bit limp as a connection. And what we need to do is, but you can prime your brain. It's not a, the stuff is in there. It's not a storage issue. It's really a retrieval issue. And she's done really fascinating studies where she finds if someone's trying to remember the name of Brad Pitt, for instance, which is kind of hard to believe, but if you can't bring that name to mind, but you know him, and later on, someone randomly says, you know, cherry pit to you, and you don't know it's connected, that word will come back to you. You will suddenly know Brad Pitt's name. And so similar sounds can prime the brain, if it's having a little difficulty, to retrieve that name that you're looking for. So it's not that it's not in there. It's just that it the connections can weaken a little bit. And particularly if their names are pretty arbitrary. For instance, we look at some guy, we know his name is Frank, but we don't know he's a banker, you know. I mean, we know he's a banker, but we don't know his name is Frank. And, you know, because the information about being a banker is much more diverse in our brains, and we can reach that information in many other pathways. But the name is kind of arbitrary, you know. Yeah. So, you know, we remember that the one of the seven dwarfs was grumpy because, you know, he was grumpy. Or I had a dentist when I was younger called Dr. Smiley, and I don't forget that.
And what you're suggesting is that although in one sense it's maybe largely inevitable that our middle-aged brain is going to be susceptible to these kind of lapses.
I think so.
That on the other hand, there are things we can do about that, and mm-hmm. at the end of the interview we can talk more about that. The subtitle of one of your chapters is The Best Brains of Our Lives, and the subtitle, A Bit Slower, But So Much Better. Mm-hmm. We should spend a couple of minutes talking about a couple of the things that the middle-aged brain does not only exceptionally well, but does better than the younger brain does.
Right. And again, a lot of this comes from these longitudinal studies that they've studied the same people again. And, you know, they find that the middle-aged brain from 40 to 60, same people again, or is better at even things like reasoning than those same brains were when they were in their 20s. Which I think is shocking, and we tend to think of ourselves as the smartest as we ever were in college or graduate school. But I think the brain continues to develop, and we get better at that kind of thing, and we get better at problem solving. We get better at getting the gist of an argument and seeing the big picture. And we also, there's very good studies that show that we get better at what the scientists call social expertise, but that's really kind of judging, you know, good guy, bad guy character. There's some great studies out of Harvard worldwide that found that people made the best financial decisions in middle age. So we do a lot of things. Our brains by middle age have a lot of connections that have been built up, and those connections and pathways help us navigate the world. And a friend is a doctor, and she gets to the hospital room, and she says she can immediately size up the situation faster. And that often leaves us more time and room, actually, to come to solutions.
Mm. I also appreciated a moment in the book when you're talking about kind of some of the positives of the middle-aged brain, talking about something that I hadn't really ever heard about or read about, at least before, something called emotional regulation.
Right.
And the fact that our sense of emotional regulation, our ability to emotionally regulate ourselves, typically, is enhanced in the middle-aged brain. Can you just say a word about what emotional regulation is?
Well, I think this is, on the face of it, is the part not to freak out over everything, you know, sort of we are calmer. But they also find that as we enter middle age, and this, again, is based on brain scanning and good, rigorous studies of real people, that we tend to look at the world in a more positive light. And we seem to be doing this not consciously, but maybe on purpose. And there's a scientist out at Stanford who studied this extensively, Laura Carstensen, who calls it the positivity effect, and that as we age, we tend to focus more on the positive than the negative, and they can watch it inside our brains as well. The part of our brain, the amygdala, that's set up to respond to the negative, responds more to the positive as we age. And again, we're not aware that we're doing this, but her view is that it may very well have to do with the fact that we know we have less time and the negative information is less important than it was when we were younger. And so we choose on some subconscious level to actually focus more on the positive. And it may have evolutionary roots. You know, I have these people who are older who have a more positive outlook and a lot of get up and go can actually help people who are younger in their care and make that the rest of the tribe thrive. So I think it makes sense, but I think it goes against what we think of our moods being in middle age.
Right. I mean, you have a section of your book called The Midlife Crisis Conspiracy, in which you suggest that a lot of the negative views that we might have about middle age are not necessarily justified at all. You give us some historical background. In fact, for the very first time, I think, I read the name of Elliot Jacques, the father of the midlife crisis. What do we attribute to him?
I wanted to go and find out, where did this come from, this idea, you know, that we all were going to, you know, I certainly bought into it in my 20s, thought it would be kind of over by midlife, and thought I better have all my adventures early on, you know. So, but what they find is, and he found, I think, when you look at the science that is sort of underpins all this enormous cultural myth that we live with, it's very, very slim, if not non-existent, talking about poorly designed studies. I mean, it's not his fault, but basically they did studies on, one study was on a small group of artists who the researcher decided was had changed their styles of art in midlife, a very small, arbitrary, selected study, and it really didn't have any meaning for the rest of us. And then there was another study basically of a small group of men in midlife. And these were men who had a particular historical background. You know, they may have come out of World War II, jumped into houses and families and cars and train rides and things, and they looked up when they were 40 and said, you know, what am I doing here? But again, that was based on a very small arbitrary group, and as they've done these long longitudinal studies of thousands of people in our modern middle age, they find that a sense of well-being, in fact, increases in middle age and sometimes peaks. Men, women, all occupations at age 65.
So are you saying
I just think it's amazing that this myth we live with, and we expect ourselves to get, you know, the red Porsches and young things or gloom and doom, is just ridiculous, really.
So that just doesn't happen nearly as often as the myth suggests?
No. I mean, the long-term studies find that maybe 5% of the people have midlife crises, and many of them, when they actually talk to these people, are people who have had crises, you know, throughout their lives.
Right, and this is just the latest.
Yeah, it's just the latest. It has nothing to do with the time frame. I mean, clearly by the time midlife happens, you know, there's loss and we lose parents and people get sick and stuff happens, you know. But overall, I think people are handling a lot. They're capable of enough a lot, and they may say they're stressed out. But in fact, the other thing that surprised me is that many people find they're quite proud of themselves for all they can do.
Hmm. You also mention another myth, which is very much tied up into the midlife crisis, namely this notion of the empty nest syndrome, and
right,
that anyone who has been a caring parent is all but destined for a period of intense unhappiness once that last child leaves the nest and they're left with all this time and no idea of what to do with it. In what way, I mean, on the surface, a lot of that makes sense if you have filled your time and your energy with the activities of your children whom you love. When they leave, that should leave us with some sense of emptiness, but you call that, at least to some extent, a myth.
Right. Certainly it's a transition, and transitions can be quite stressful for some people. So again, not that it doesn't ever happen, but I went in search of also the roots of this one. And this one is even, the roots are even sillier, really. It was the first mention of an empty nest syndrome, which launched this whole idea, was in the 60s. And they some researchers studied some women who were very poor immigrants who were already in the hospital. They were clinically depressed. And the researchers found out that this random group of women, who were like 18 women, had also, their children had recently left home. And they decided, well, maybe part of their clinical depression had to do with the fact that their children had left home. And, of course, these women were extremely isolated, very poor, and had no language skills, and were already clinically depressed. And believe it or not, that is where it started. And I just couldn't believe that one. So, because I, too, bought into this. I thought, you know, I have two kids, and I love them dearly, and we are all quite involved with our children these days. And I really thought when they went off to college that I would feel the same way as I, you know, the empty nest syndrome. And people talk about it all the time and ask you about it. But I found I was, in truth, when they do these large studies, they find it isn't true, that people basically, if their kids are happy, the parents are happy. And you're proud of the fact that you've accomplished, if they're raised well, you're happy for them. And actually, relationships improve with kids sometimes when they're out of the house. And so I find This whole cultural thing that we've grown to expect is based on nothing, and it didn't seem to happen to me, and, you know, I love them dearly. In fact, they're back again. Empty nest? I don't think so.
Right. Let's finish up with just a word about the way in which someone wants to make their brain better than it is and to perhaps shore up those areas of deficiency in the middle-aged brain. You say over the past few years, as it has become clear that memory itself is not one thing but many and that some parts age better than others, the question is, can we fix the parts that need a little help? You do zero in on a couple of things that do seem clearly to make a difference for the better.
Well, exercise is one. Unfortunately, you know, it really is the one that has the best solid science behind it. Over and over, they find that, you know, the brain needs oxygen. So we simply have to move around. Our bodies are made to move. And for many years, they thought that the brain was kind of isolated from the body, protected and alone up there. And what we did with our bodies didn't matter. And that's now not thought to be not true. Our bodies are very much, our brains are very much like our bodies, and you have to think of your brain as like your heart. So whatever you think of doing for your heart in terms of cholesterol, exercise, high blood pressure, you're really doing for your brain as well. So it's important to avoid illness if we can, you know, from cardiovascular disease to stroke, very bad for the brain. And exercise is key. And beyond that, I think they are chasing, now that we know we don't lose all these brain cells, the whole field of, you know, it's very hard to bring a dead brain cell back to life, but if you have a brain cell that's alive and just needs a little tweaking, the cognitive scientists are really chasing this very hard to figure out, you know, what is it about red wine or blueberries or spinach that can really help our brain, and they're looking at you know, of course, the antioxidants we've heard about in the very colorful fruits and vegetables seem to be key because they seem to be involved in the repair processes of our brain. So what they're trying to do is figure out the dosage. Nobody knows, and nobody knows which antioxidants is good for you. So unfortunately, the best advice for now is what our mothers told us, to eat a balanced diet and lots of fruits and vegetables. You know, they're trying very hard to figure out the right dosage and put it in a pill and make a fortune, frankly, but I don't quite know which one is best yet. So, and again, the brain activities, I think, you know, being social, we've heard about that. It's kind of a cliche, but the reason is it's not just la-di-da, hang out with other people. It's that being with other human beings is very hard work, and it makes your brain work hard. And so that's, they think, one of the things that you should do for your brain. And the other one, my favorite that I heard along the way, was for the adult brain to learn best and to keep developing. The people who study adult learning say the best thing you can do is talk to people who disagree with you. Your brain likes a good rut, you know, and to make it keep going and growing and stay alive, that it's best to challenge some of the assumptions that it's built up through the years. And it doesn't mean you have to change your mind. It just means that you should confront yourself with things that make your brain a little uncomfortable. And, you know, kind of, and then reflect on how that kind of fits into your own worldview. And that will give you a much more complex view of the world. And that's what the middle-aged brain is good at. You know, we aren't so good at memorizing, you know, the names of everything, but we're really set up to get a more complex, nuanced view of the world. And that's, I think, what the middle-aged brain is really talented at.
In the epilogue, you say, the best way to start it, to my mind, is to finally give our middle-aged brains the respect they deserve. Maybe it's time to take that broader middle-aged view to appreciate and to put to fuller use what we still have inside our heads. The book is The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind, published by Viking, the author Barbara Strauch. Barbara Strauch, I have really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for writing this great book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Partly cloudy skies today and rather windy conditions. A 30% chance of a little snow this afternoon, a high of 33 degrees. Cloudy and windy overnight with a 40% chance of light snow, a low of 31. Cloudy and mild tomorrow, flurries and showers, a high of 35. Friday's high, 36 degrees. Saturday, we may see a high of 42 degrees, similarly mild on Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.